Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to the Don and Ron Show. I'm host Ron Edwards, coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul on a rather chilly evening here in the upper Midwest. A lot of things happening across the world, if you will. It's certainly Ebola, certainly tensions renewed in Ferguson, Missouri, and St. Louis, Missouri, as racial tensions continue to climb after the leaking of additional information. We'll be talking about that within the next 15 minutes. But first, the entire world was gripped around 9:52 a.m. this morning when it appears now, a single gunman who also appears to have been a convert to Islam, according to some of the statements being made, and an address to the Canadian people and the world by Canada's Prime Minister, opened fire at the, and this is really macabre, if you will, and raises serious questions to how mean-spirited people can be. The gunman, who also is now deceased, opened fire on one of the ceremonial guards at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which is just a half a block away from the Canadian Parliament, just across the street from the office of the Prime Minister, and etc., shooting the Canadian military person in the back, killing him, if you will, and then racing across the street, up the hill, as they call it, and into the Parliament, the place of governance of Canada, if you will, of the Dominion of Canada. He exchanged gunfire with numerous Canadian security personnel. Some say as many as 50 shots or more were fired. There seemed to be at least two other locations where there was gunfire. The Canadian Parliament, as of the broadcasting of this program at approximately 8:32 Central Standard Time, daylight Central Standard Time, the Canadian Parliament is still locked down, as they said. The American Embassy in Ottawa is locked down. The Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C. is locked down. NORAD, the protective, quote-unquote, air umbrella over the North American continent, if you will, went on full alert. American, Canadian fighter jets were standing by to be scrambled if there appeared to be unauthorized penetration into restricted airspace, if you will. And so for about 10 hours now, there has been a lot of tension. The Royal Mounted Police indicate that they have been, this is interesting, have been looking at about 90 Pacific jihadists, if you will, or potential jihadists. Some others within the Canadian government have said in the last 4 or 5 hours that number could be 200, if you will. This comes on the heels of 3 young American teenagers from Colorado, ages 15, 16, and 17, according to the reports out of Germany and the United States, who left their homes, unbeknownst to their parents, according to the parents, and were attempting to travel to Turkey, and then some maintain travel across the Turkey border into Syria, into the conflict involving the military factions there, including, of course, ISIS, if you will. The decision by these 3 young children, if you will, 15, 16, 17, to make this kind of sojourn is certainly causing a lot of conversation. In fact, there would probably be even more conversation tonight if not for the terrorist attack on the seat of power in Canada, the Canadian Parliament in Ontario, if you will. Of course, the Canadian intelligence services, of course, joined by the United States, by Britain, and others taking a close look if this was a conspiracy, if you will. If it is a conspiracy, how deep does it go? Who is involved? Who is financing it, if you will? How were the plans made? Now, as we said earlier, just a couple minutes ago, it is still not clear if there was one gunman, two gunmen, three gunmen, four gunmen. That has not been totally cleared up. Consequently, the Canadian Parliament, almost 11 hours later, is still on lockdown, if you will. In the coming days, we and the rest of the world will hear whatever the scenario is that the Canadian government and the major networks, both Canadian and American, and of course the American intelligence community, will give to those of us, the citizens, quote unquote, of both nations, if you will. If in fact this was a coordinated attack, if you will, if there turns out to be more than one gunman, it represents another failure of Western intelligence, if you will, both Canadian and the United States, with as much surveillance that we are told is in existence throughout the United States, Canada, and Europe, if you will. When something like this takes place, one wonders how it happened. The Canadians, who have always prided themselves on being a very reasonable people, a very kind of peaceful people, but people who are somewhat linked to isolationists to some degree. The Canadians enjoy their style of life. They reside in a very large country, a beautiful country in many places, if you will. Canadians are, quote-unquote, very reassuring to themselves and have played an important role on the world stage. And one of those features, if you will, of the Canadian people has been how they handle the issue of violence, guns, and etc. And though there have been periodically, 30 years ago today, a very upset Canadian Special Forces soldier, a corporal, if I'm not mistaken, walked into the Ontario assembly, if you will, like a provincial legislature, and took control, held hostages. Ultimately, after 14 or 15 hours, he was talked out, ironically, by the sergeant-at-arms of the Ontario legislative group, if you will. And the reason that becomes rather interesting and kind of eerie is that the word is that it was the Parliament's sergeant-at-arms who actually exchanged gunfire with the deceased gunman, bringing him down and possibly saving many, many, many lives, if you will. And so tonight, if we were in Canada, if you will, you would be glued to your television sets, be you in the Maritimes, or if you were in the French-speaking Quebec, or if you were in the metropolitan and Cosmo, Toronto and Ontario and et cetera, or if you were in Manitoba or Saskatchewan or British Columbia, if you will, you would be glued to your television sets. In fact, they are probably glued to their television sets up in the Yukon and the Northwest Territories and et cetera. And so everywhere in Canada, Canadians are now discussing and debating, and that's one thing Canadians love to do, is to debate, if you will. They see that as a sensible form of government, if you will. I've always maintained that if we had or were more inclined to accept parliamentary forms of government here in the United States, we would be more enlightened, if you will, be more intelligent, if you will, about the issues pertaining to our country, quote-unquote, to our government, quote-unquote, if you will, to our political process and its success and failures, its positives and negatives, and et cetera. And so certainly one will watch closely. There will probably be some backlash as it pertains to the allegations that the deceased is a most recent convert to Islam, if you will. We've seen this happen before here in the United States. We certainly saw it after 9/11, if you will. Right under the surface has always been the anti-quote-unquote Islamic concerns and et cetera, if you will. Unfortunately, the issue of race continues to come into play. But again, it was a harrowing time in Ottawa, and at approximately 9:52 a.m., maritime time, if you will, as they call it, Eastern Standard Time, as gunshots rang out, a city, well, at least the downtown area and a portion around the downtown area, almost under a state of martial law. There's already been discussions about copycats, and in the last hour and a half, the bulletins have come across the screen, if you will, the monitors and et cetera, that an individual jumped the fence. There we are again at the White House, if you will, attempted to sprint towards the White House, was not shot and killed. We do have reason to believe that this time around they released the dogs that they have. They have some very well-trained German shepherds, and they can bring you down, cause you enough confusion and attention to allow the human security personnel to then secure you and take you into custody. But how much thinking is going on in the United States as we speak with regards to copycat, or how much reflection has been made based on calculated decisions? You know, there have been a lot of people that have been coming into this country illegally. We have the whole situation with the Ebola, you know, and certainly the decision under some great pressure by the Obama administration to put a quote-unquote restriction on flights out of West Africa, if you will, particularly the Ivory Coast, Guinea, and, of course, Liberia, if you will. Restrictions, though, by the way, there are no direct flights from any of those black West African countries. The Ebola situation also comes at a time when it appears that two nurses of color, who for whatever reason seem to have gotten the assignment to have attended to Thomas Eric Duncan, the Liberian citizen, who is surrounded even after his death, his demise, if you will, with a lot of questions about when was he infected. He was not infected when he entered the United States, but he still must have been in the incubation stage, and et cetera. But the one thing that is quite clear, particularly given the announcement that the NBC photographer, white photographer, has recovered from Ebola and is being sent home from the University of Nebraska's Medical Center at Omaha, Nebraska, if you will, that will certainly open an additional or one more bed, and that we only have 11 beds in the whole United States of America. And when we say beds, we're not just talking about a place to go into the hospital and lay down. We're talking about a place that is secure and is serviced by all of the necessary wherewithal, hardware, technology, and et cetera, to at least safeguard the medical personnel who are attending to the infected person. Of course, Thomas Eric Duncan, a black Liberian, didn't get any of that consideration. In fact, it's still hard for Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas, Texas, to explain why Mr. Duncan was not admitted the first time that he came to the hospital, if you will, asking for consideration, asking for assistance, asking that his life be saved, really, you know, when you think about it. But it didn't happen for whatever reason, if you will, and folks cannot explain why it was that it happened, if you will, why it was that Mr. Duncan was not provided with the best, if you will, of medical attention, as would have been given to any other Caucasian who had, you know, medical insurance and et cetera, if you will. And then just the puzzling piece of the two nurses that were specifically assigned to him, one Asian, one African-American, if you will. Hopefully with God's speed and God's blessing, they will recover, if you will. Apparently the decision was made to give them some of the miracle drugs, such as ZMAP, which we've been talking about here for the last month. ZMAP, the miracle drug that has been around since not 1979, but 1976. Again, we call your attention to the book Medical Apartheid, as well as the book The River, Medical Apartheid by Dr. Washington, The River by Edward Hooper, if you will. Examination of man-made viruses and et cetera. Don't you kind of get the feeling a little bit, my friends, that Ebola could very well be an infectious disease that is man-made? Ooh, God help everybody if it is finally shown that, in fact, Ebola is a man-made chemical slash biological, more importantly, a biological weapon that was actually put together back around 1954, 1955, at the same time that HIV had been developed in the laboratories of the United States Army after Nazi scientists and et cetera had been captured by the United States in 1944, if you will. Wouldn't that be a startling revelation? By the way, one of the top people in the world on that particular issue will be in our city tomorrow, if you will, at 10 in the morning at the Humphrey Institute, the longtime activist, if you will, Dick Gregory. We'll be here joining Clyde Belcourt, the longtime activist leader of the First Nation people, if you will, in preparing for protest and demonstrations at the November 2nd Viking game at TCF Stadium. It will be very interesting. We welcome Mr. Gregory once again to our enclave, if you will. But Dick Gregory was a man who in 1981, 82, began to talk in terms of the HIV and other infectious diseases, as we did also. In fact, he and I were on a panel together at the International Market Square here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Wonderful program. We provoked a lot of discussion at that discussion, if you will, that workshop that he and I participated in as we talked about this man-made infectious disease that had been leveled against black Africans, if you will, primarily in the then, as it was called, the Congo, if you will, but also showed up in places like Guinea, places like Sierra Leone, places like Liberia, places like Nigeria, and et cetera. By the way, accommodations to the Nigerians and the Senegalese governments for being able to anticipate what was being actually done in West Africa, if you will, through the insistence of Chinese intelligence agencies who made the Nigerian and Senegalese government aware that infectious disease and experiments were taking place. Their countries were being targeted. The Nigerians did one heck of a job of setting up the necessary protocols and headed off an epidemic inside of Nigeria, if you will. Now, the three countries we previously reflected on did not have that luxury per se, if you will, and consequently their medical infrastructure was decimated in just basically a two-month period of time. But for those of you that have the time and have the interest, if you can find the books, by the way, the books are not easily obtained any longer in the United States, the book The River by Hooper and the book Medical Apartheid by Washington, if you will, and the book The Man Who Cried I Am by Williams, a book first published in 1965 here in the United States, which talked in terms of genocide being developed and initiated against the African-American or Black American problem here in the United States. Three books that would make good interesting reading for those of you that are interested, if you will. And so we have not forgotten the situation in Canada. How can you? Given the scare, like we said before, though, there will be time to reflect, digest, if you will, dissect, if you will, and hopefully somebody will give us the real and true narrative of who was involved in a military-style terrorist exercise that brought terror to the capital of Ottawa, if you will, and went directly inside the seat of power, the House of Parliament, which is similar to our beloved, quote-unquote, Capitol, if you will, which contains our House of Representatives and our Senate in that great building, if you will, just up the street on Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House, if you will. So this is how things are moving, and we certainly will be keeping our eye on it, but we felt at the top of this program tonight that what happened in Ottawa warranted some reflections, if you will. And as we said before, you can look forward to some resurrection and increase anti-Muslim, anti-Islam rhetoric and attacks and et cetera. It's in fact already started. It's amazing how, going back to the Ebola situation, how so many conservatives such as Senator Cruz of Texas can hold poor President Barack Obama directly responsible for every aspect of every problem that this world knows, if you will. They're now blaming him for the Ebola. In fact, I bet you by tomorrow morning they will be blaming him, President of the United States, for quote-unquote not being on top of his game as a gunman or gunmen attacked the seat of government in Canada. You know what I mean? So they'll make him the Canadian Prime Minister responsible to the British Commonwealth, if you will. You may say that that's silly and simple and et cetera. No, it's not. It's the way things have been working. And many of you out there in America know that this is the way things have been going, the continued undermining of America's first black president. By the way, the president's very lovely wife, very talented and very well enlightened first lady. It was in the city of Minneapolis yesterday to help Al Franken win a second term as United States Senator, junior senator from the state of Minnesota, as well as some other lesser candidates, if you will. Everyone that was in her presence talked in terms of her eloquence, if you will, of her insight, of the charisma that she, in fact, radiates. I've always said that actually she would make an excellent presidential candidate if things were to really honestly work like that in America, but it's not an America that's, you know, ready for that, if you know what I mean. Want to turn to Missouri. We possibly will have a call coming in from one of our resources because of the technical difficulties that we would have in the absence of our prime technician, Mr. Allen. He will not be able to hear the conversation via this transmission. But we have asked our operatives, sources, and et cetera, to update us on some problems that have again emerged in Ferguson, Missouri. There it is again. And I appreciate the fact that the Attorney General late this afternoon indicated his concern and anger, really, with the continued leaking of information by the St. Louis County prosecutor, McCullough, if you will, a man who is perpetrated on doing everything he can to undermine the African-American community. We have a call coming in from Missouri. Yes, sir, caller. Thank you. Appreciate you calling. Can you give us any update, and we will kind of repeat what it is you say to us. What is the latest with regards to, number one, the grand jury situation? We now see reports coming out of St. Louis that the grand jury will be making its findings known in mid-November. This is after 3 weeks ago saying that they wouldn't have anything until mid-January. Could you just enlighten us, and I will kind of repeat it as you say it to us, from Missouri. What is the situation with the grand jury in St. Louis? How many leaks, sir, have come out of the grand jury? And we appreciate you confirming on your end, particularly in light of your position there in Missouri and the bureau that you work for. How are the leaks being handled in Missouri that are coming out of McAuliffe's grand jury, which is under his direct supervision and domain? At the grocery, at the convenience store that we talked about. Now, my math tells me that Michael Brown was shot and killed by Officer Wilson on the 9th day of August. It is now the 22nd day of October. My math says that's about 78, 79 days. Is that seems to be about correct math, right? Yeah, and so the latest information from out of Missouri is that the autopsy from the St. Louis County, this is not the autopsy report that was commissioned by Mr. Brown's family, an independent autopsy. And then there's a third autopsy, which is the FBI's autopsy, which was given to the National Forensic Institute by orders of Attorney General Holder. So actually there were three autopsies. Am I correct, Missouri? Okay. Now, the St. Louis County Medical Examiner never took the occasion to either respond nor to release his medical examination until now, as we said before, about 74, 75 days after the death of Michael Brown. Now, much is being made by the New York Times, by CNN, by Fox, by white media, that because there is at least one bullet wound, which was shown in the two other autopsies done by the Brown family and done by the National Forensic Institute, so that's not really new, but I understand what is new is that the St. Louis County's autopsy or medical examination now indicates that there is DNA in the form of blood and maybe particles of skin and other matter as an outgrowth. And we now hear that two shots were fired inside the police car and that Mr. Brown was shot in the arm, as well as there was some damage to his between his thumb and index finger. Is that correct, sir? Let me repeat that for our listening audience. Our caller from Missouri, MI7 is the code name that we have given this individual, that they're now saying there was residue on a powder residue or gun residue on Mr. Brown. Is that correct? Okay. Let me repeat that again. Scenario out of St. Louis, Missouri, out of Missouri, is that Mr. Brown probably did not have his hands up. This is the narrative being advanced by the county prosecutor and, of course, by his good friend in the medical examiner's office, that Mr. Brown never did have his hands up, okay? Mr. Brown had traces of marijuana in his system. Is that correct? Okay. Though, let us be clear for those, for our international audiences, if you will. There was never any weapon, right? We haven't been able to, or they haven't been able to come up with the weapon. Sometimes I like to talk in third party. So they never were able to drop a gun on him. So that's the weapon piece, which they're going to have to deal with under color of law in order not to indict Officer Wilson. Let me ask you this question, sir. What is the feeling that this grand jury, which also has leaked information such as the following, they don't think that enough evidence has been presented for them to be able to indict? What is the feeling right now in St. Louis about the possibility of justice? In 1965 or 64, correct, all right. Right, okay. Now, what has happened in the case of both the Myers and Powell shootings? You see, folks have quickly forgotten Mr. Myers is the young man just killed who the police said exchanged gunfire with the police before his gun jammed after three shots. He was shot something like 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. 17 shots were fired at him. And then, of course, Mr. Powell, if I remember correctly, was the African-American shot by two white officers right around the end of August who allegedly had a small kitchen knife in his hand, correct? Okay. And, yeah, the knife that even as you look at the film, you can't see the knife in his hand. But they said, and by the way, I understand that the dashboard camera on the police car in the Powell shooting wasn't working or something like that. But anyways, okay, so we had three African-Americans in about a period of a couple months under very mysterious circumstances, a lot of shots being fired by the police, Mr. Brown, Mr. Powell, and Mr. Myers, correct? Okay. Is there any expectation? Now, of course, I'm like a lawyer. I already know the answer to the question I'm about to ask, but is there any expectation that there will be an indictment of white police officers in any of these three killings? Let me repeat this for our listeners. Our caller is enlightening us now that Governor Jay Nixon, Democrat, Missouri, has recommended early this afternoon that a Ferguson, I think the name he put on it was the Ferguson Task Force, and that this would be a blue ribbon. They always like to use the word blue ribbon, that a blue ribbon task force will take a look at the problems within Ferguson. They can take a look in St. Louis, which is only 15, 20 miles away. So if they're going to do Ferguson, they say, go ahead and do St. Louis. But that they're going to put together this blue ribbon panel, and they're going to – what are they going to do, caller? I asked you the question during the production meeting. I mean, what is this committee going to do? Now, am I not correct that the Missouri Attorney General had made some pronouncements months ago about problems within St. Louis County, and particularly some of those smaller enclaves like Jennings, which their police department was disbanded because of its racist activities. And in fact, that's where Officer Wilson worked for the first 2 years of his police career, correct? Jennings, Missouri, okay. And so the governor, Jay Nixon, a Democrat, is now wants folks in St. Louis County and all through Missouri to believe that this Blue Ribbon panel will address a problem that has been there since time immemorial. Is that what we're supposed to be led to believe? The power of the governor's office. Whatever that. Now, I have to say, as a person who certainly has researched the law and has a great appreciation of the law, even though it's out of balance in America, will the governor exercise, or does the Missouri Constitution give the governor subpoena powers? Oops. Or does the Missouri State Supreme Court have to give that panel those powers? Let me do this. I appreciate you taking the time in my five. We want to establish right now that next week we will have Mr. Allen back with us. We will have our full technical capabilities. I would like to bring you on, and we'll bring you on at the top of the program next week. That's right. We have someone who will be coming in, be talking about. We will have you on about the same time next week, and we would like for you to give us an even more detailed overview and citing articles and et cetera and statements from the governor's office on this Blue Ribbon Ferguson panel. And I would like for you, sir, if you would, there in Missouri, if you would research the law as it pertains to what powers the governor, Jay Nixon, can exercise and facilitate as it pertains to the powers of the committee, starting with subpoena authority. All right. All right. Want to thank you, MI5, MI7, for taking the time to share this with us. We're sorry that we had technical problems, if you will, for whatever reason. But we will be listening for you at around 8:45, 8:50, next Wednesday night. All right. Thank you, sir. All right. All right. That was MI7, a citizen, we'll put it like this, a citizen of the state of Missouri who has continued to enlighten us from his position, if you will, in Missouri on some of the goings on. He also provided us with excellent background last week over the Ebola scare in Greater Kansas City, in which now authorities have kind of just done what they do best with this Ebola situation, just kind of don't talk about it anymore. Now, there's been no update on the patient who was quarantined at the University of Kansas Medical Center at Kansas City, Kansas, if you will. For those that did not have a chance to hear that program, we invite you to go to On Demand and listen to last week's program and also give some thought to the whole situation with the cruise ship, with the Carnival cruise ship that about a week ago was denied docking privileges. And I can understand both the government of Belize, a Central American country bordering Guatemala and Honduras. The Belize government said, nope, you can't dock here with an infected patient. Mexico, our good friends in Mexico, who send so many across our borders, if you will, said, nope, you can't dock here. And finally, I think it was late Saturday evening, early Sunday morning, the Carnival cruise ship docked in Galveston, Texas. But one of the things was interesting, and we had this discussion with MI7 in Missouri, is that the gender changed. Initially, the report was, and we have it on tape and et cetera, that it was a female medical technician from Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas, Texas, who had also been a part of a group that was under voluntary quarantine. She had decided, that was their initial report, she had decided to take a cruise in the Caribbean 4 days after Mr. Duncan died, if you will. And yet on Saturday, CNN running a report on the Carnival cruise ship identifies the Ebola patient as a man. And so they couldn't even get the gender and the sex right. So that's part of the chaos that is going on. But again, we appreciate MI7 out of Missouri, and we're looking forward to hearing some additional reflections. Let me be more specific on the panel that Governor Jay Nixon, Democrat, Missouri, announced that he wants to set up, that he wants to put together a blue ribbon panel. Obviously, he'll reach out to some black folk. I mean, he'll have to play the game. And they want to take a look at how the problems of Ferguson, as we said, that certainly if you're going to look at Ferguson, you're the same to look at St. Louis, because you killed two in St. Louis and only one in Ferguson. I mean, you know, we kind of keep a scorecard, if you will, with regards to police activity and et cetera. And so the governor is wanting to set this up. We asked the following question. We repeated on this blog radio program. What constitutional authority under the Missouri Constitution does the governor have to compel anybody to come in and do anything as it pertains to testimony, if you will? Because if you don't have people at least taking an oath where you can look at the issue of perjury, then it's just really a waste of time, if you will. We're really sorry tonight that we really didn't have the phones to be open. We know that there are people out there that certainly want to talk in terms of the hearing. Remember the hearing? People have been waiting, or at least saying that they're waiting, that took place this afternoon at approximately 2 o'clock, that said that Senator Jeff Hayden, senior senator, Minnesota Senate, and Assistant Majority Whip, was testified this afternoon before the Senate Subcommittee on Ethics, if you will, two Democrats, two Republicans. Different versions coming in from different folks based on who these folks are and their interpretation of what it was they heard. But these are facts that certainly will probably be in, I assume, the Minneapolis Star Tribune tomorrow. And that is, number one, Senator Jeffrey Hayden testified for, between he and his attorneys, testified for about an hour and 45 minutes, if you will. Some observers at court indicated that Senator Hayden did very well in responding and refuting allegations that he had received compensation and et cetera, that his father had received compensation during the course of a business transaction. This comes on the heels of a open letter sent to the governor of the state of Minnesota, Mark Dayton, at around 6:30 a.m. this morning on the new website of a group calling itself something like the Association of Negro Educators in Minnesota, if you will, led by a St. Thomas Law professor, a radio personality, if you will, a couple of other people. But anyways, the letter to the governor implied that there had been a series of negotiations involving people that had previously been named by another group, if you will, in attempting to acquire large sums of money through the legislature and the governor's office. Now, we first reported on this program about a month ago that at one point the amount that was being requested was $10 million. This other group now says that the amount was $26 million. Again, we encourage people to, and we know some of you already have out there here in the Twin Cities, we encourage you to, enlighten your friends, tell your friends where they can find this posting, if you will. And in the course of doing that, take a look at some of the monetary figures that are being kicked around. Again, we repeat that the posting indicated that negotiations, almost secret, clandestine negotiations, were going on in which $26 million was to be signed off on by the Dayton administration and handed over to these individuals, some of whom were identified on a white radio station here a couple of days ago, 11:30 a.m., as well as a couple of other radio stations, and et cetera. We want to be cautious because we are told by sources who were present and observed the testimony of Senator Hayden this afternoon, hour and 45 minutes, as it pertains to the examination of him, his statements and reflections, if you will. Oh, by the way, the issue of any kind of criminality by his father, Dr. Peter Vincent Hayden, if you will, the executive director and founder of Turning Point here in Minneapolis, was laid to rest. There was no smoking gun. There were no canceled checks. There was nothing like that that showed up, if you will. There's some debate about the document that was sent from the Minneapolis Public Schools, MPLS, as they refer to, in which the initial allegation was made sometime in May, was it, that the two senators, Senator Hayden and Senator Bobby Joe Champion, had bullied, threatened, and et cetera, the superintendent of the Minneapolis Public Schools, if you will. A week ago this past Tuesday, delegations said that they were going to descend upon the school board meeting and that they were going to confront the directors of the Minneapolis Board of Education, that's what we call them here, as well as the superintendent, make them come clean about the kind of threats that were made, and et cetera. None of that seemed to play itself out today, if you will. According to multiple sources, we made sure that we have more than one hour observer, if you will, who were present in the room in the state, in the state capitol, if you will. A room was packed, according to the sources that reflected on both the testimony and et cetera. A large media contingent. We had assumed that already KMSP here in Minneapolis, Channel 9, has shown some excerpts, if you will, from the hearing. We know that the Minneapolis Star Tribune, as we speak, has already posted its early edition. It'll be interesting to see what their reporters say. Let me further indicate that Dr. Hayden responded to the statements made in both August and September that he was on the payroll of a nonprofit organization, that he had received remuneration and et cetera, that he was on the board of the organization and et cetera, in a letter to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which the Minneapolis Star Tribune has declined to publish, if you will, which is certainly disturbing, if you will. You would think that there would be some fair balance and consideration, fairness, if you will, based on what has happened. But we are made to understand by reliable sources, once again, that the letter has not been printed, will not be printed, if you will. So what we would like to do as we move into the last 10 minutes of tonight's program, and again, we certainly would have liked to have had our technical operation moving along so we could have received any calls of anybody. But what we are going to do is take you know what we're going to do. We're going to read the letter in its entirety because it's very short. This letter was from Dr. Vincent Peter Hayden to the Minneapolis Star Tribune. That is the major paper in this state. The Star Tribune did not accurately report my relationship with Community Standards Initiative, CSI, in its articles dated August 19th and September 24th, 2014. Like many others, I am troubled by the violence in our community and am committed to creating positive change in North Minneapolis. For that reason, I was happy to join community activists and representatives of the Minneapolis Police Department when CSI began an initiative late this summer to identify and implement programs to reduce violence. My involvement with CSI is no different from any other collaboration with a number of other organizations working to improve lives in North Minneapolis, including the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department, Protect Minnesota, Shiloh, Temple, and the MPD's Public Safety Department. To be clear, I am not and never have been an employee or board member of CSI. I have never had a contractual relationship with CSI and have never received any compensation from CSI. My role is simply an engaged citizen working with this and other organizations to affect a change in our community. I am disappointed that my attempts to clarify my role with CSI has been ignored. Thank you sincerely. And again, Dr. Vincent Peter Hayden. This letter was sent 2 weeks ago by Dr. Hayden. We thought it was important and asked Dr. Hayden to provide us with a copy, as he has provided both Insight and our the Spokesman Recorder, the two major African-American papers here in the state of Minnesota. But we choose to read this letter so that for those that have made statements relevant to Dr. Hayden's integrity and et cetera, that some way or another he has shied away from, cowered away from responding to the articles. Again, for those that like to work the computer, work the little mouse on the computer, if you will, those articles are dated August 19th and September 24th, 2014. At some point, we think that Minneapolis Star Tribune should, in fact, do a Q&A with Dr. Hayden, as they did with Superintendent Bernadette Johnson, if you will. I guess I'd like to know some of the contracts that Superintendent Bernadette Johnson made available to folks that no one is talking about, and if, in fact, there are dollar amounts that are far in excess of what, quote-unquote, our two state senators are being accused with malfeasance and misconduct, if they are contracts that are, you know, like in excess of that. We just think that that's the fair thing and the right thing to do. But there is also some ambiguity with regards to when the next portion of the hearing that took place this afternoon at the state capitol under the supervision of the Minnesota Senate's Committee on Ethics, if you will, as we said earlier, two Democrats, two Republicans sitting as the examiners, if you will. We had thought that there would be others that would be called or would offer to give testimony. Apparently, that's not been done at this point. Senator Champion, who also has been brought before the Ethics Committee on issues pertaining to the CSI controversy, if you will, is to have his hearing. I think it may be the 13th of November. I think that's a Thursday. But for those that are interested, if you will, you need to check. Now, in closing, I go to something that Dr. Hayden said in his letter to the Star Tribune, asking for corrective action. We have had a series of terrible violent acts in our city over the last couple of days. And one of the things that troubles me greatly, we speak to it on our television program to be aired here this Sunday, is when you, it's bad enough, you know, when men, young men, old men, et cetera, decide to take each other's lives. But when you begin to see women acting out a similar kind of scenario and taking lives and ruining their lives, if you will, such as the shooting at Augie's in downtown Minneapolis, where a very lovely young African-American woman, a young woman, was shot and killed by another young African-American woman. Both women having such great futures in front of them, if you will, having so much to offer. And then at a corresponding time, early Saturday morning at approximately 1:30 a.m., an altercation across the street at a club called the New Yorker. Two African-American women get into a confrontation. One is injured, goes to her car, gets in her car, drives recklessly into the street, strikes the other young African-American woman, putting her in the hospital in critical condition. We've not heard an upgrading of her condition in the last 72 hours, if you will. A lot of loose talk in community about what is going to happen if people don't keep their mouths closed, if you will. I'm not quite sure I know what that means. I've heard it said before, and I know that there are some out there that are extremely dangerous with regards to such things as threatening, and people are saying that they are looking for the possibility that there were some words of anger expressed at the hearing outside of the hearing of the legislators and et cetera. We hope not. We have enough violence going on now that things escalate, because people do not want to honor and respect a person's right to speak, sometimes to make a fool out of themselves, sometimes to say the right thing, if you will, and to give credence and authenticity to facts and et cetera. But people need to be allowed to do that. And then you, as a community, as a people, as a race, if you will, you will make the determination, you will be the judge if in fact there is validity and if in fact the person is believable, if you will, and that person can be respected for that believability and the authenticity of what they said, or should they then be dismissed as a person that is not providing factual information and being a coward, if you will. You, as the community, make that determination. You make that judgment. No one should make it for you or attempt to make it for you. And so we hope that at some point the wounds that have been opened, and as we said before, the letter to the governor raises serious questions about just how violent, if you will, conditions are within our community. We thank you for tuning in. We'll be back with you, hopefully with our co-host, next Wednesday. May God continue to give you strength and sustenance and vision. On behalf of the program, Ronnie and Donnie, good evening.